KABU 90.7 FM Community Radio and the Clinton Street Theater are proud to present The Yes Men Fix the World. Thursday, November 14th at 7 p.m., KABU will be showing the 2009 indie classic film The Yes Men Fix the World. The Yes Men Fix the World is the true story of two political activists posing as executives of giant corporations. In their thrift store suits, they lie their way into big business conferences and pull off pranks. That's The Yes Men Fix the World, November 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm/yesmen2013.
DJs play
45 RPM records
all day.
Tune into KABU on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records,
while from noon to 8 p.m. we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue with refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th
in person at KABU from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight
to celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45RPM2013.
What's going on? What is
it? We're marching, Joe. We're marching.
We're marching. Where are we marching to?
We're marching backward, Joe.
Backward?
Backward.
Backward?
Yes.
Isn't that very hard to do? I mean, you know, especially with the goose step and all.
It is hard. It takes a concerted effort to march backward.
I think it's probably easier, though, than marching forward these days.
Well, yeah, one would think. Or one would surmise based upon the sheer number of people marching backward.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Is that, are we straining a metaphor here?
I think we are. I think we've strained
Okay, I think
completely.
It's time to tell people. This is KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial, Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call, 231-8187. What are we doing?
Well, we're going to talk about voting rights.
Voting rights? You ain't got no voting rights. Oh, yeah, you do.
Yeah,
you're
still
a white
I'm
male.
I'm a white guy.
White male.
I still got them.
Sorry, you got them. Yeah.
You still got them.
I got them.
I'm pretty sure.
I'm not sure.
Did you change your name when you got married?
Did I change my name when I got... No.
Okay, then you're all right.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
But we'll get back to that in a moment.
Yes.
In case you've been hiding under a rock, the United States historically has had a little bit of difficulty expanding the franchise to all of its citizens.
Well, yeah, we started out with just property-owning white guys.
Yes, just property-owning white guys. Then it became all white guys.
Yeah.
Then it also became black guys.
Yeah.
And then eventually women.
Yes. 1920, I believe.
Right, right. But that wasn't until last century.
Well, yeah.
Almost not even 100 years have women had the right to vote.
Well, yeah, right. You know how they vote.
They probably vote just like you or I vote.
Unfortunately, it seems so,
it's not
yes.
a question of anatomy or disposition. It's a vote.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, choices are limited to two parties, Tweedledums and Tweedledees.
Yeah, indeed. But generally speaking, women tend to vote for the left of center Tweedledees instead of the right of center
Yeah, that is a pattern.
But I digress.
Yes. Don't digress.
Yeah, but even after the franchise was expanded to include additional classes of people beyond landed white men, there has been a concerted effort instigated, led by those same white men, to make sure that these new groups of newly enfranchised people had difficulty voting.
Yes.
You've heard of Jim Crow.
Yes.
Can you sum up Jim Crow for us briefly?
Well, briefly, there were a series of laws. Well, gosh, this is really a very important concept. After the Civil War, there were what are called black codes in the southern states, in which essentially black men and women, if they didn't have gainful employment, were forced into contract labor and forced onto the land and couldn't leave. They were not free. That was the first ideation of this. Congress responded by creating the 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment. And then after that, there was what was called Jim Crow, which was a series of patterns that became very, very rigid and very, very obvious by the turn of the century, in which black people were in a segregated society, both segregated in terms of location and lifestyle, but also in terms of monies. The differential between wages of blacks and whites were very noticeable. Black people suffered from enormous discrimination. And most importantly for our talk today, they could not vote.
They could not vote. Why?
Well, because, what do you mean why?
Well, I'm trying to get at, was this some random occurrence, or was there a systemic attempt to keep them from voting?
Yeah, no, it was very systemic, and very much shared throughout, unfortunately, much of the nation.
I suppose it would be systematic rather than systemic.
I suppose systematic would be the right word, yes.
Right. So, in response to decades of this systematic attempt to keep the wrong people from voting.
Yes.
We had the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, which culminated in two major landmark pieces of legislation, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
Again, didn't make the problem go away, but was established a significant set of legal precedents to ensure that the problem was largely mitigated.
And in the process, destroyed the Democratic Party's southern power.
Right.
And the Democratic Party turned Republican, as it were.
Right.
In the South.
So one of the key provisions of the Voting Rights Act was that on a precinct-by-precinct basis, those jurisdictions that had shown a history of systematic attempts to keep minority voters from voting, these jurisdictions would have to prove affirmatively to the federal government from time, I believe it, the period was every 10 years, I could be wrong about that, but they had to show the federal government that they were not engaging in these sets of activities that that conspired to keep black people from voting and other minorities from voting. They had to show, lay their cards on the table and say, we are not doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
The idea being that while we are taking steps to eliminate this sort of institutionalized discrimination, the driving forces behind it were still there. And unless we kept a very close look on what they were doing, there is a chance that it might raise its head again.
Yes.
So last summer, the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, struck down this provision of the Voting Rights Act and said that even in those jurisdictions that have shown a historical tendency towards systematic discrimination in voting, they no longer have to prove that they're not doing it.
Because everything's okay.
Because Barack Obama and stuff.
Yeah, like
everything's
that.
Racism's gone.
Yeah, it's over.
Yeah, it's gone. It's been legislated away.
Magically disappeared. And meanwhile, throughout the country, not just in the South, but throughout the country, there was a pattern which had existed from way, way back in the 1800s called the gerrymander.
The gerrymander.
And the gerrymander, it's an animal, a fake animal, a mythical animal. I don't want to get into historical naming and so on. But basically what it is, if you look at a map of all of the voting precincts and all the congressional districts in the United States today, you will see some that run along a highway and then suddenly blossom out here and blossom out there. And they're not rational. They're not cut along geographic lines. They're not cut along reasonable population lines. What they're cut along is party lines.
Right.
And the result is that you have a Congress of the United States today, which is disproportionately not representative of the American voting population. For example, the population as a whole voted for Barack Obama twice. But in fact, district by district, congressional district by congressional district, because of gerrymandering, the Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, is disproportionately Republican. And these oddly shaped districts are why that is the case.
Right. So that's its own set of problems.
Yes.
Right. So the Voting Rights Act, this provision was overturned by the Supreme Court last summer, and almost immediately, new oppressive, restrictive, discriminatory voting legislation began to pop up around the country.
What kind of stuff are you talking about?
Here's the deal. It has never been necessary in the United States until fairly recently to show a photo ID when it's time for you to vote.
Oh.
All you really had to do when you registered to vote was to show some sort of proof of residency.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm Joe Blow. I live at 123 Main Street. Here's my electric bill. I live there. I want to register to vote. And you would register to vote. You didn't have to prove your citizenship. You didn't have to show a photo affirming exactly who you were. The fundamental nature of voting was deemed to be so important that these hurdles were not put in place, that everyone was assumed to be who they were, and that they were free to register wherever it was they happened to live and mm-hmm. vote. No problem.
Well, that was the essence of one man, one vote.
That was the essence of one person.
One person, one good point. Vote. One person, one vote.
Right, exactly. But since the Supreme Court ruling last summer, this is no longer the case. And state after state after state, these voter ID laws are popping up. They're making it a requirement to provide photo ID not only when you register to vote, but when you show up to vote. On the grounds that voter fraud is rampant.
Is voter fraud rampant?
No, voter fraud hardly ever happens. It is statistically insignificant. Not enough voter fraud has happened in the history of American voting to swing the outcome of a single election. It is that insignificant a problem.
Except, I have to say, in Kansas prior to the Civil War. But never mind.
But never mind. So it's really not a problem. This is a paper tiger, the problem of voter fraud. But it goes back to this systematic attempt to oppress the wrong sorts of voters.
I.e., what are the wrong
sorts usually of people with darker skin tones.
Ah.
People with without penises.
Aha.
People like that.
Oh, yes.
So it's become apparent, I believe, that conservatives in this country have realized that substantively they cannot win, that history is leaving them behind, that their ideology, their methodology, their belief, for example, in the intrinsic superiority of maleness, particularly white maleness, is a thing of bygone eras. They cannot win on the substance anymore. The only way they can continue to maintain their hold on power is to take steps to ensure that only the right sort of people get to vote.
I.e. white males.
I.e. white males get to vote.
Oh, well.
And here's how
I'm one of them. That's okay.
That's all right. Yeah, you're fine. Here's how this voter ID system is causing problems. The most restrictive new law has arisen in Texas.
Ah, Tejas. My favorite state.
A very restrictive piece of legislation requiring, for example, that your ID that you show when it's time to vote match exactly the name listed on the voter rolls, regardless of how long you've been registered, regardless of how long you've been in a particular residence.
Okay.
For example, say for a moment that you're a woman. And you get married, and you decide to take your husband's name.
Which is the most common thing.
Which is the most common thing. And let's say that you had a driver's license issued several decades ago, and you have your maiden name listed as your middle name on your driver's license. So let's say you're Mary Smith Johnson.
Okay.
Smith being your maiden name, but it's now listed as your middle name, which was the practice for a long time.
Yes.
So let's say your ID says Mary Smith Johnson. You go to the polls and you find that that name on your ID doesn't match the name on the voter rolls, which maybe was the name you had before you got married.
Ah.
Now, under the terms of this new voter ID law, you can't vote.
Wait a minute. Because your previous name, your birth name, is on your ID and the name you've taken is your married name, you can't vote?
Yeah. If those two names don't match exactly. And I'm talking about even with suffixes, if you're a man, like if there's a junior or a senior or a Roman numeral 2 or 3 or whatever.
What about all the Hispanics who, when they marry, take on the names of both families?
Then you've got a problem. Unless those two names match exactly.
Ah, so you get rid of all the Hispanic vote.
Yeah, indeed. And you know who changed their names far less often than any other class of voter?
Who?
Men!
Oh!
So while on paper, while in theory, this piece of legislation might be in place to ensure that voter fraud cannot take place, in practice, it is discriminatory against those classes of people who have historically had a difficult time voting for reasons very similar to this, because white dudes didn't want them to.
Wait a minute. So the Supreme Court said, in essence, the Voting Rights Act works, therefore we'll throw it out.
Yeah, essentially, that's what they said.
And then, state by state, these gerrymandered state governments.
Yes.
Make rules that essentially exclude people whose names are not exactly matching the name that is somehow the name in the government list.
Yes. Yes, and they're requiring many people who may not have a piece of photo identification, particularly elderly people, to go out and get one if they want to vote, even if they've been voting their entire adult lives. And this can pose some serious problems, particularly in rural precincts. For example, there are some counties in Texas where there is no Department of Motor Vehicles office.
Ah.
So if you want to get yourself a voter ID, you've got to travel a long way. You've got to spend the money to get where you're going. You've got to spend the money to get a piece of photo ID. You've got to spend the money to get back where you came from.
Well, that's good. You get rid of poor people voting, you know.
Well, see, there was a thing back in the Jim Crow era called the poll tax.
What's a poll tax?
Joe, tell us what a poll tax is.
Oh, the poll tax is a tax that required that you must pay to be able to vote.
Right.
There was also literacy tests, which were differentially harder for persons of color than and Hispanics than other folk.
So you had to prove you could read and write before you could vote?
You had to prove you could read and write complex legal language.
Oh, wow. So if you weren't white, though, you got a harder test.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So the argument from opponents of voter ID legislation is that this essentially amounts to a poll tax. If I've got to make a significant investment, more significant if I'm poor, to get myself a piece of voter ID, that is essentially a poll tax.
So you have to be prescient. You have to be aware that you're going to need this new identification, that you have to go and find it, which can be very difficult in a state like Texas where distances are significant and where governments are located not really near you. And then essentially you have to spend the money on the kind of ID that's required.
That's correct.
Oh, well, you know.
That's essentially a poll tax.
Oh, well.
And it is an abrogation of someone's innate right to vote as a citizen of the
United
States.
But the Supreme Court said this is not a problem.
The Supreme Court says this is not a problem. Said we've come far enough that these districts, those with a historical tendency towards voter repression, we've come far enough that they don't need to affirmatively prove they're not oppressing people anymore.
Ah.
And so, like I said, immediately in the wake of this decision, we saw these pieces of legislation begin to spring up. Mostly, and this will be a big surprise, I'm sure, mostly in the old Confederacy.
Ah, the old Confederacy.
The old Confederacy. And now we're heading towards the thesis of today's show, and we're going to get there in just a moment.
Well, I'm getting ready.
Now, I need to point out that while this was happening mostly in the old Confederacy, it was not confined to the old Confederacy. Some of these jurisdictions that the Voting Rights Act required to show evidence of lack of discrimination existed in places like California or in Michigan or in certain parts of New York. Any place that showed a history of this sort of thing.
Mm.
But now they don't have to do anything. Now they're free to repress whoever they please.
Well.
So.
Well.
This is getting back to my thesis that has come up a number of times in recent shows.
Yes.
That that many of the conflicts we're seeing politically, socially today, the rebellion of the Tea Party, the prevalence of voter ID legislations, the renewed attempts to crack down on a woman's right to be the master of her own body. All of these things.
Mistress of her own body. Yes.
All of these things are a last-ditch attempt by an entrenched patriarchy to maintain a certain standard of masculinity as the definitive quality of the ruling class in this country. Their belief is that the ruling class in this country should be white, it should be male, and further, it should represent a certain brand of masculinity, specifically Southern masculinity. What we're seeing now is the Civil War still playing itself out in the 21st century.
So your thesis is essentially we've regressed to 1864 or something.
Yes, that the problems we're seeing now politically and socially in this country are mostly coming from the Old South. They are mostly coming out of the old paradigm of white supremacy in the Old South.
But I think there's another component which really has to do with not just with whiteness, but with moneyedness.
Yes, indeed, there is. And why don't you explain that?
Well, obviously, if you create a system that discriminates against people who are less well-educated, who are less likely to have fulfilled these legal requirements, who are less aware of what's going on, which tend to be people who have more wealth, who have more knowledge of systems and how they work, it's going to have an impact on voting activity.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
So what you're really doing is you're reinstalling the old system that previous to the civil rights movement was extremely common.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But what are we going to do? What?
Well, I think we should take some phone calls.
I think we should.
231-8187 is the number to call. Here's who I want to hear from today. I want to hear from white males. Because we never hear from men
on this show.
If you're a white male, how do you feel about all this? Or which side of this divide do you fall on? I have a feeling where most of you will come out.
Well, I'm all for penis power.
And even more than white males, I want to hear from you if you're not white and if you're not male. I want to hear where you're coming from on all this. Do you feel like all the ground that you've managed to gain in the last few decades, is that suddenly slipping out from under your feet? Do you feel like we're actually marching backwards to the 1800s here?
Well, and here's an irony beyond all that, which is, in fact, the choices that people frequently have in national elections, in congressional elections, even in local elections, are so limited to the Tweedledum and Tweedledoo.
Uh-huh.
That it almost, for many people, it almost seems irrelevant who you vote for. I mean, I'm thinking about, for example, the decision by many of us to vote for Barack Obama in 2008, 2012. The dude is not anywhere on any of the issues that I really care about. He's nominally a liberal, but he has done everything in exactly the same pattern as you would expect if this were the administration of a Bush or a Reagan.
So say, you're saying Barack Obama's living proof to the thesis long held by many of us on the left that there is little to no difference between the two major parties.
I'm afraid so.
That you have a right of center corporate friendly party in the Republicans and a slightly left of center corporate friendly party.
I wouldn't even call it left of center. I'd call it center of center. The Democrats are the center of the center.
Yeah, the Republicans are way out there on the fringe now.
Well, what's
now that the Tea Party is taken.
Right. What's happened is you have a resurgence of reactionary sentiment expressed by the Tea Party movement, which I want to make clear is not a spontaneous movement, although many people in it think so. Was actually manipulated by the Koch brothers and others to create this enormous apparent push to the right.
And if you ever wanted to see a personification of scared Southern masculinity, it is the Tea Party.
Yes.
Look no further. Well, let's go to the phones.
Yeah, let's go to the phone.
James, good morning.
Oh, it's James. Hi, James.
Good morning.
Hey, what's up?
You guys are showing yourselves to be nationalist and conservative reactionaries.
Oh, cool.
How do we do that, James?
Well, see, the people do have a right to vote. Women did have a right to vote. Blacks had a right to vote from the time of our nation's founding.
Stop, James.
Let me finish.
Yeah, let him finish.
Okay.
It was the people who had control of the voting, not the central government.
Wait a minute, James, just one question. When did women vote prior to 1920? And where?
That's not the issue.
Wait, is it?
You just said that they could vote.
They had a right to vote if they wanted, if they chose to.
Oh, James.
They have a right to vote if they chose to.
That's not so, James. You can't get on the air and talk bull. You can't.
No, it's true.
It's not true. James. Let's just try this out. I have studied American history. I have taught American history. I know American history. You are full of it today. You really are. And I'm going to say goodbye to you, James.
Hold on.
Goodbye, James. I can't.
I kind of wanted to hear him explain that.
I know, but counterfactual nonsense just doesn't have a place here on KBOO.
Well, it serves to...
I mean, I'm willing to hear arguments on the right, but they got to be fact-based.
It serves to make our position look rational by comparison.
Oh, yes, there's that. You know, we can look better by having absurdities pushed forward by people who make up history, I guess.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Okay.
Do you think I'm intolerant? Should I have let him prattle on there?
I don't think we would have gotten anywhere, but I would have been personally amused.
Oh, yeah, well, that's true. It would have been funnier. I'm sorry. I ruined the fun.
Okay, so we've established one thread of today's conversation, which is that the reactionary politics, the reactionary social movement embodied by the Tea Party is the latest battle of the Civil War.
Yes.
metaphorically speaking.
Metaphorically speaking, as it were.
Right.
Now, I like as it were.
You brought up the subject of money. Now, that's a very interesting topic in the context of this conversation.
Well, sure.
Because for a long time, generations now, decades now, moneyed interests among the conservative ruling class have convinced poor white people to vote against their own economic self-interest.
Right.
By exploiting, usually, fears about race.
Well, and also grand notions of national specialness.
American exceptionalism,
right.
Fears about race, fears about losing their privilege as patriarchs.
Right.
When all this time, poor white folks have had a whole lot more in common with poor black and brown folks than they do with rich white folks. But essentially, rich white folks have been able to convince poor white folks to vote against their own interests because, hey, at least they're not black. At least they're not brown. At least they have that going for them, right?
I guess.
So money figures into this, but not in the way you might think.
Not in the way you might think. Explain that.
Okay, well, so reiterate what you said earlier about how money has figured into this whole process.
Well, I think money, first of all, in a modern electoral process, you can flood the airwaves, you can flood all of the media with advocacies that can be totalized for your whoever candidate you
yes.
and whatever party you want.
Yes.
And in that process, you can drown out any voice of reason that's counter to that.
Indeed.
In fact, the show before this, talking about Henry Wallace, who ran for president as an independent progressive back in 1948, the money classes in both the Republican and Democratic parties' establishments drowned out the voice of what had previously been the normative politics of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Okay.
So money talks, the rest of it
money
walks.
Money talks. What I'm saying, however, is that there have been poor white folks for decades in this country who, if they really wanted to advance their lot, would have voted with the Democratic Party, for lack of a better option. But they have not. They voted against their own self-interest because the money class has told them to.
And, in fact, we have two parties which are representative of the established order.
Yes.
We don't have, for example, a social democratic party like in Germany, let's say. We don't have a left at all left in America.
Oh, we have a Green Party.
Well, weak and limping. You know, and no money pouring into its coffers, so it can't really be taken seriously.
Yeah, that's true. You sort of have to have money to be taken seriously, don't you?
You do.
Because money is speech, thanks to another brilliant Supreme Court decision.
Exactly.
Let's go to the phones.
Okay.
Dave, good morning.
Good morning. You wanted a white male to call, so I thought I'd give you a call.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for making that sacrifice, Dave.
Unfortunately, I'm going to kind of agree with you on this one. I think, though, it's worse than you think.
Oh. Explain.
I think we're not just trying to go back to the 1840s. We're trying to go back to the 1500s.
Really? What do you mean by that?
I think if you look at the change in economics, for we're creating a whole culture of slavedom and serfdom. And at this point in the world's history, we're now actually rising the number of worldwide slaves owned by rich white folks.
Okay, now you're using the term slave slightly metaphorically, right?
No.
Oh. You mean actual slaves?
I'm talking about actual slaves. So it takes some time to look into the slave industry worldwide. It's huge.
Well, that's true, but I don't think it's true in the United States so much.
It's true in the United States. It's just under the covers.
Well,
you look at a few of the wealthy politicians who've been caught with these undocumented aliens working for them for substandard wages. That's slavery.
Well, it's
so
not.
So you are using the word slave sort of metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that people are abused and kept in ignorance and often employed without much choice, except they do have the ultimate choice of walking.
Well, you may think they have the ultimate choice, but a null choice is no choice. And if you perceive that you have a null choice, that's really no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so while you may, sitting on the outside, say, well, sure, they have the choice of walking, from their perspective on the inside, they don't have that choice.
Well, I think we're splitting hairs here, but I think your point overall is to suggest that there are a lot of people, I'm just checking with you here, that a lot of people really, because of the need to meet their basic needs, the bread on the table, the housing, so on, are stuck in a situation where they're really choiceless.
Right.
Okay. I don't like to call that slavery.
I would also say that the spread of wealth is going the same direction.
Well, it's true. Wealth is definitely accruing more and more at the top. In fact, the wages in America have not, in terms of real money, risen since the 1960s. So we really, really, in fact, are very poor. I was amazed when I looked at
No, we're not really poor. We're losing ground in comparison to the very rich.
Well, I think we're losing ground in comparison to the Europeans.
From a global perspective, we are an enormously, enormously wealthy country with a huge standard of living.
Yeah. We still, even the poorest people here in this country are better off than the poorest people in other countries, in many other countries.
Well, absolutely. I don't disagree with that.
But having said that, that doesn't mean they don't have problems. I'm completely sympathetic to their problems and their issues. But, you know, the point is that we are trying to go back to a period of time where the very wealth ruled the world and the little people on the bottom didn't count. And the Supreme Court decision about corporations having rights was appalling.
I agree with you on that. I think the language, we're arguing about language rather than fact. I think, Abe and I apparently disagree about something. I think that if you compare the standard of living of a Western European person with the standard of living of the average, similarly average American, you'd be kind of shocked at what they get and what we don't get.
I completely agree with that. And that's, again, why I say we're not just headed back to the 1840s, we're headed back to the 1500s.
Well, listen, hey, thank you for the call.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Appreciate it.
Bye.
231-8187, this is KBOO, 90.7 your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, and we do want to hear from you, 231-8187.
Now, I will accept your comparison between the United States and industrialized Western European countries.
Okay.
Yes. But you compare the lot of a typical American with that of, say, a typical Haitian.
Oh, well, you're talking about the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Right. Well, I could choose any number of countries from any continent on the globe.
Okay.
The point is that as a wealthy industrial Western nation, we have it pretty well, all things considered.
I'm not going to argue about that.
Let's go back to the phones. Who's next, Steve?
Sherelle. Good morning. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. I'm enjoying your show so much. You're cutting through my dense stupidity.
Oh, come on now.
I think you have illuminated the argument pertaining to the echoes where all of this is really coming from. But I did want to say where our poor are in this country, I don't know if we're really so much better off than the rest of the world's poor, because where our poor are, they're dead. They've died from homelessness, or they're in prison, or they're living a few inches away from homelessness continually because people are scrambling for mick jobs, which are part-time, no benefits, no wages, not enough to pay the rent, not enough to feed their families. They are indentured servants, which is kind of what I talked about before. And under the slave economy, it was in the slave owner's interest to feed somewhat their slave and maintain their investment for a period of time. But an indentured servant is disposable. You know, you've got them for a while, you use them up, and then you throw them out. And I have to speak for all of those people that are in prison or are just about dead somewhere, and there's a lot of them, and we know that there are many of them. Anyway, I just think your discussion is really important, and I'm glad that my family and I brought in $600 in pledges to KBOO so far.
Oh, right. Yeah, that gives me an opportunity to thank people who did make a commitment to KBOO.
We are poor people. We are poor. Well, I'm particularly poor, but I have poor brethren, and we're across many Indian nations, and we appreciate KBOO, and we appreciate this discussion. So,
hey, well, thank you so much for your support of the station and this show.
Here's where we run into a problem. When we start comparing across the board the people in what used to be called third world or developing nations with people in the United States, we look good.
Yeah.
But when you, in fact, look at the history of the United States and the pattern of wages and the pattern of opportunity for Americans, we don't look so good.
No, we don't look so good.
So I think what we really need to do is avoid the cross-cultural comparison for our purposes and just look at the history of our own country and our own populations and realize that if you're like, let's say you're an 18-year-old male or female today and you have to make choices, you have to go into debt to go to college. Unless you're one of the very, very few who get scholarships, and that debt is a debt you cannot discharge. You have to carry it forever until it's over. Mm-hmm. That's one choice. Another choice is you can go to work, but as has been said, you can go to McBurger and work and work and maybe meet the nut of your life if you share an apartment with others or a whole host of other things. Soon you will get health insurance, but prior to the Health Act that was just passed, that was out of your reach except to go to an emergency room and become indebted there. The actual life of the actual American ordinary person isn't so fun.
No. I think part of the problem is that the middle and working classes were sort of lulled into a false sense of security during the post-war decades when there was really an unprecedented ascendancy of the middle and working classes when compared with the strength of the ruling class. That was an historical anomaly more than anything else. I think what we're seeing is sort of a correction back to the status quo that has existed since civilization began.
Well,
that is, that there's a small ruling class that lords it over everybody else.
Well,
and thus it has always been.
Right.
Except for that period after the war.
Right. And in fact, what we saw in late 1930s into the 1940s into the 1950s was a very rapid rise in the wealth and potential and education and a whole host of other things among working class, and a word we don't use much anymore. We talk about middle class.
Life expectancy.
Yeah. Those things. Now those things are starting to be reversed. The reversal began really with, I think, about around the time of the death of Kennedy or a little after that. And I think it's important to understand that. By the way, I wanted to give a site I've just been handed by our producer, Freedom Center. That's one word. freedomcenter.org, /slavery today. He says if you go to that site, you discover that slavery is a problem in the U.S. today. So I haven't looked at the site, but, you know.
Yeah, there's probably human trafficking going on in this country.
Oh, there's certainly human trafficking.
Certainly. That would be shocking to us, but we don't see an entire segment of the economy propped up by slave labor like we did in the agrarian Old South.
Right.
Where that doesn't exist anymore. Okay. Little business here.
Business.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, Alternative Radio presents an archival lecture on cultural and imperialism by the late scholar Edward Said. At 10, here Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, lawyers for the parents of 13-year-old Andy Lopez, who was shot and killed by a Sonoma County deputy sheriff.
Well, yeah, had a little fake gun.
Held a press conference yesterday to explain their federal civil rights lawsuit. We'll hear audio from the press conference. At 11 on stage and studio, host D.M.A. Roberts talks to author Jamie Ford about his newest book, Songs of Willow Frost, set in Depression-era Seattle. It's the story of a 12-year-old Chinese-American boy. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake speaks with Darren Orange, a painter from Astoria who is well known for his emotional and expressive work based in Oregon or in the Oregon landscape. All this and more coming up today on your listener-supported radio station.
That's good stuff.
It is good stuff. McDonald's. Mentioned briefly.
So I love McDonald's, McBurger.
All right, here's something rather interesting I came across earlier this week, or last week, rather.
Yeah.
McDonald's has a hotline in place for its employees that they can call and be connected with social services like food stamps and temporary aid for needy families.
We just cut food stamps.
We did. But McDonald's is providing the service because it knows its workers are struggling, and it benevolently wants to connect them with these government services. Well, and they are touting this, McDonald's, as evidence of their great compassion for their workers. Well, screw you, McDonald's. Maybe if you paid your workers a decent wage, they could afford these things, and you wouldn't have to depend on the rest of us, the taxpayers, to pay your workers for you.
But wait a minute. I mean, your burger would cost a buck more.
I don't care. If I got to pay 75 cents more for a Big Mac, which I don't go to McDonald's anyway, but let's say I did, I would happily pay 75 cents more for a Big Mac if I knew that McDonald's didn't have to steer its employees towards food stamps and government assistance because they're too damn cheap to pay them a living wage.
I admire your outrage.
Why, thank you.
I think it's totally appropriate.
This is something I think we need to be talking about more. We hear from the right all the time about this class of moochers who do nothing but sponge off the rest of us with things like food stamps and things like temporary assistance for needy families. Well, maybe if corporations like McDonald's didn't expect the rest of us to help pay their workers, we would be in better straits.
Perhaps. Yes, I think so.
Let's go back to the phone.
All right. 231-8187.
Mike, good morning.
Hey, again, thanks for the show.
Sure.
And been a member for a while. I hope all the members out there get new members.
Yes.
Yes.
Seems like we're stuck taking care of ourselves.
I think so.
What's on your mind?
Oh, speaking of going back into the past here, the gerrymandering issue.
Yes.
It's not only nothing new, but it shows the nastiness, the on-purpose nastiness of the Republican Party, like in the Texas, where the Democratic Party literally left the state in order to keep the gerrymandering from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was obvious, it was clearly racial and poverty lines that they were snaking their districts through to get a bunch of white rich people on their rolls for their Republican districts.
Well,
and now we're more divided than ever in this country, all over in every county in the country, like you said earlier. Can I give you an example of the same sort of insidiousness that becomes mythology and covered up by something else?
Sure, do it.
The witch trials in Salem. Well, the research has gone back to the records, and if you have a map of that area, that county and the cities, villages, and look at put a dot at every witch that was identified,
mm-hmm.
and where every dot, or put a dot, another colored dot, where the accuser was,
mm-hmm.
it was a few rich people on the rich side of the tracks accusing a few poor people on the poor side of the tracks.
Now, no, there were no tracks, just to be clear. Anyway. Go ahead.
That's a metaphor, yes.
Your point is very interesting. So you're suggesting that was a power struggle there as well.
Yes, and it was intentionally misleading by using the freakazoid magic of the day. But they knew what they were doing.
Ah.
The mean-spirited power people can use any language they want to rationalize what they're doing. But it's all about this power. And like you say, what's happening is a last-ditch effort of white power thinking, boy, this is a war, and, you know, we got to win because we don't want to lose.
Right, sure.
But they're going to lose, whatever. And, you know, I feel pretty privileged being in my position that I am. But, yeah, I see that all around me. Anyway, you have a good one.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, appreciate it.
You know, it's interesting. Really, when you start looking at the history of the United States, really looking at it, the pattern is pretty clear throughout our history. When, in fact, reforms have occurred, the ability of the system to absorb dissent and to limit dissent is very clear. So what we're really talking about is a class structure that persists through time. And at this moment in history, the ascendancy of a very moneyed, I mean billionaire moneyed group has become very apparent, and the Supreme Court has essentially said, oh, go for it.
Yeah, that is exactly what the Supreme Court has essentially said.
So any reform effort, and the Supreme Court plays a very major role in all of this. it was a liberal court that created the possibility for African Americans to have equality. It is a liberal court that created a lot of possibilities, including women's rights to choose and so on. Now, suddenly, we find ourselves in a very reactionary climate where I suspect that we will see the rollback of all democratic rights by a court that is essentially 5-4 reactionary. And I'm going to guess that when Ruth Bader Ginsburg retires, her replacement, assuming it's under President Obama, will be a moderate at most and very possibly a mild conservative. I think we're seeing a significant movement of the whole of the United States government to the right. We're waging war. I mean, I want to bring this in because it's important. We're waging war through drones. We are an imperialist power operating in other countries. We have invaded pointlessly several countries. I won't say pointlessly because oil is involved. And in fact, the American people are totally mystified because we're still talking the language of World War II when, in fact, this is not the world of World War II.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg had a fantastic analogy when the Supreme Court overturned the Voting Rights Act this past summer.
What'd she say?
She said overturning those provisions was like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet.
There you go.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones.
231-8187.
Ralph, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I guess I disagree a little bit with Abe's analysis. I think that it's leading us into further dividing us rather than trying to explain what's going on. And I'm not saying that some of what you're trying to say is valid, but I think that...
Well, with which part do you disagree? Let's start there.
Well, you're saying this is some sort of last gasp of the Confederacy.
Yeah, that might have been a little grandiose. Okay.
People that are motivated... you know, this is their main motivation, and you've talked about this for weeks. So you're making it look like this is one of the primary points that's going on in American politics today. Where I think that the people on the so-called right are being used, being manipulated, just as much as any other group, and that. I just don't see that as a main thread that's going on in politics today. One of the people that ran the Clintons' campaign, Larry Nichols, which you should try to get on as an interview sometime, he's basically refused to join Hillary's presidential run because he's had enough of those folks. But he has said that she will be the next president. And that the Tea Party is a technique to force a third party in this country to ensure that she gets elected. Because what happens is they got set up. They, you know, that there was like, oh, we're going to shut down the government, we're going to shut down the government. And then all the top leaders, Democrat and Republican, got together, basically, you know, made a deal. And now you have a lot of frustrated people that are going to throw a party campaign out there. So whoever runs against Hillary is going to be someone that's unelectable, and that's the game that's being played.
All right, let me make sure I understand you quickly. You're saying that the Tea Party movement is a construct engineered to fracture the conservative party so that Hillary Clinton can emerge triumphant in the next presidential election. Is that what you're...
Well, it's not specifically Hillary. What I'm saying is that the Democratic Party, you know, long ago has been taken over, which Joe has pointed out. It's a centrist party. There is no left. The left has no power in this country. They decide who's going to be in, and what they do is they throw money at the person that can't be elected. I mean, just look at people that have run against Bob Dole. John McCain against, you know, Obama. I mean, these things I'm just saying there's manipulation going on, and I just think your analysis psychologically further divides the country. You could say, I just was up in... and on Mississippi Avenue playing a gig last night. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of white people that have run all the blacks out of there just as much as, you know, your analysis of these crazy far-right people being anti-black. Now, not with the same intent, but, you know, for all practical purposes, those communities have been, gentrified. You can't find hardly any black folks living up in northeast Portland anymore. So, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, people do what they need to do to survive, and then your analysis is that they're doing it out of some, you know, for ideological reasons. Everyone's being manipulated.
All right. I will concede that. I'm not sure that I agree with your larger point, but yes, I think virtually every point on the political spectrum is being, or at least attempting to be, someone's trying to manipulate it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that there's people that that are doing exactly like you're saying, but I'm just saying that they're being used as just as much as everybody else is.
All right, and fair
so
enough.
I think you're making that a central piece of the pie. I just think the slice is much smaller and there's much more going on.
Well, listen, thank you very much for the call and for the perspective.
Yeah. Cool.
All right, so maybe I shouldn't be quite so grandiose with my historical metaphors.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, here's the problem. We have very short period of time. We talk about stuff in a very perhaps glib way. But in fact, I think our argument, our central argument today, if I understand it correctly, is that there is a reversal of fortunes and of possibilities for ordinary people in America through manipulation of vast, powerful moneyed interests. Not a new thing, but a new form of the thing. We see a restoring of an old-fashioned system of limiting voting rights and so on. These are real truths. Now, to argue that the Democrats, for example, are in the hands of the similar moneyed interests is not the point. And it is true. It's just not the point. The point is that the ability of Americans to make rational political decisions and then vote on those decisions is continuously being limited in the context of a society that reduces the wealth, the power, the health of ordinary Americans. And we even see in the case of the health care law, a law designed to essentially make the insurance industry happier and is so complex and so poorly structured in its beginning that it seems like it itself is proof that any kind of national health insurance doesn't make any sense. I mean, we just see these things going on. I don't think they're accidents exactly. I think they're expressions of the limited understanding of the people who do rise to power, along with the interests of the ruling class, the true ruling class.
I want to throw into the discussion right now a quote from the late, great Molly Ivins.
Oh, yes. I always
wonderful
liked her.
Texas journalist.
Yes.
This is Molly Ivins. It is possible to read the history of this country as one long struggle to extend the liberties established in our Constitution to everyone in America. I think that is absolutely true. We have struggled since our founding in this country to live up to the ideals enumerated in the Constitution and to extend those liberties to everyone in this country. And I think what we're seeing now from the Tea Party, to use a prominent example, is a reactionary pushback against that, against the perception that white males are losing their traditional position of privilege in this country.
Well, I think many people are involved in what you're describing, but I also think that there is a continued struggle at the level of national politics to make us engage in the same kind of imperialism, despite its disastrousness, that has characterized our politics since 1940.
Should we go back to the phones?
I think we should go back to the phones. 231-8187. This is KBOO. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
Lori, good morning. What's on your mind?
Hello. Sometime in your history, it would be nice for you to mention the Southern Democrats, which a lot of us know a great deal about. But isn't the subject the impossibility of all of these people getting a national ID card? Is that the subject today?
Well, that's how we sort of led our way into this larger discussion, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just don't think that that's – I think that would have great advantages, especially if someday we do get a single-payer insurance system, and there's always that possibility. But those of us who have been the victims of identity theft, for us to have a more comprehensive, real way to identify people, I have to pull out my photo ID regularly to manage in this world. Mm-hmm. In this one town they keep mentioning in Texas, we could always have some kind of a mobile system to go to them to get their thumbprints or whatever we have to need. We're not stuck with stagecoaches these days, you know. We can get to people. They must have to sign up for health care and a whole lot of other things, but these things are not impossible. So to me, I'd say, great, I think a national identity card with your definite photo and print on it would be a great advantage. And some of us, including me, do have screwed up birth certificates. Mine is only a week off, and every so often I do get tripped up on it. So what?
Really?
I'll do it. Yes.
Okay. No, I appreciate the comment. I also think that you're entering another kind of conversation about national identity cards. Many countries in Europe do issue for individuals an in-nation identity card. Now, the United States doesn't. We are built on a federal system, which makes states extremely powerful relative to this question. And I'm not sure that would ever happen here.
Well, I was born in Maine in a town of 300, only I was 5 miles out of town, and we did business back in the 30s. And I think we can find some way to get to these people again. And having more and more authentic ID, I think, is to our great advantage. And I would myself do what I could to get to people who are that place in Texas you keep referring to. I think we could reach. Okay.
Okay. Well,
hey, thank you for the call.
I thank you very much for the call.
Who's next, Steve? Barth, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. you had a talk about McDonald's helping their workers get food stamps, et cetera.
Yeah.
Budget in Washington, there are a couple of bills going on, one of which would cut SNAP benefits by $4 billion out of the $80 billion budget. And the second one, over several years, would cut the SNAP budget by $40 billion, which is in half.
What is SNAP? I'm sorry.
SNAP is supplemental nutrition.
Okay.
It's the food stamp over.
Right.
Yeah, McDonald's is probably going to have to expand their food bank and their call center. I wonder also if the Supreme Court would be amenable at all to revisiting the voter rights issue, if they see how much havoc they've wrought and facilitated by cutting this out. You know, if you can go and say that, you know, this legal decision has had these consequences, there are mechanisms in place to have some of those decisions revisited. I wonder if the Supreme Court would be at all approachable on those grounds.
Yeah, I don't have much faith in this current Supreme Court, but you raise an interesting question. I also wanted to, since you brought up food stamps, when the original Abundant Foods program was started, it actually was a way of getting rid of food surpluses in the United States, and it was under, and still is under, the Department of Agriculture. That program evolved into little storefronts that you could go in and get a big chunk of cheese and a Velveeta cheese.
And canned peanut butter and canned stuff.
And then came food stamps after that, and then came the identity cards. So we've seen a process evolve, and the program really moved to the acknowledgement of the fact that many people do not have enough money to live a decent life and have a decent amount of food. And now we have a Congress that is ruthlessly cutting programs for poor people. And that is apparently a part of a national movement to consolidate power on the right. That's all. I just wanted to get that out.
Also, just the idea of nutrition at very young age making such a difference in terms of function, intelligence,
sure,
progress, success over time.
Right.
And that this is a kind of a chicken shit maneuver for the future. And
all right, we're going to have to let you go. Sorry about that.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
One more phone call?
Yeah, one more.
Who do we have, Steve? Oh, let's try that again. Who's next? Hello?
It's Ed.
Hey, you're Ed. You're there. What's up?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I think everyone should have the right to vote. I think the country is stronger when everyone is able to contribute and voice their opinion. And I think it's really important for KVU to demonstrate that philosophy. And I think even people like James should be allowed to at least express themselves so that you can counter with whatever your argument is. So any time that you see that kind of intolerance, it should be pointed out.
All right. So here's my general philosophy with callers like James. You know, I'm willing to let them say their thing and then rebut them most of the time. But today, James came out swinging with such ridiculous, on-its-face stuff. that we just had to let him go.
I actually have to let everybody go. I want to appreciate your call. Unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, and I want to urge you to keep tuned to KBOO for the best in public affairs and music programming.
All right, we'll see you next week.
Exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Visegrad Group PDX Festival, November 9th from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. To celebrate the 95th anniversary of independence of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian nations, this one-day festival will share traditions, history, arts, and crafts, and national food of the Czech, Polish, and Hungarian communities within Multnomah County. Again, the Visegrad Group PDX Festival will take place at the Polish Hall, 3832 North Interstate Avenue, on Saturday, November 9th, from 1 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First Alternative Radio presents an archival lecture on culture and imperialism by the late scholar Edward Said. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris André. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints. Lawyers for the parents of 13-year-old Andy Lopez, who was shot and killed by a Sonoma County deputy sheriff, held a press conference yesterday to explain their federal civil rights lawsuit. We'll hear an audio from that press conference. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Demay Roberts talks with author Jamie Ford about his newest book, Songs of Willow Frost. Set in Depression-era Seattle, it's the story of a 12-year-old Chinese-American boy. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Ava Lake speaks with Darren Orange, a painter from Astoria who is well known for his emotional and expressive work based in